Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save It for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community. Cool. Well, welcome back to another episode of Save It for the Blind. Today we have Mark Henley, Vice President of Advocacy for CWA, and we're going to be doing kind of a touch-up about what's coming across the legislature soon, what we're supporting, what we are opposing, everything from state grants to youth and vet weekends to Pintail. So, Mark, where do you want to start on this? I'll let you kind of run it for a while.
Well, given that we're coming up on the Fish and Game Commission meeting to set the regs for next year in April, why don't we start there?
Okay, and when's that meeting?
It is going to be April 16th, Wednesday. It'll be in Sacramento. A lot of the commission meetings now are in Sacramento. So I'll be there to provide testimony on behalf of CWA, and hopefully they'll go with our recommendation. We'll see.
So everything will be adopted on the 16th, and then within 24 hours, everyone will know what to expect during the 25-26 waterfowl season.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I'm sure we'll make a social post about it for everybody to get notified.
Absolutely. So you have a couple of things you're working on. You have the youth and vet weekends switches. I mean, the last couple of years, it's kind of varied which weekend, days rest, no rest, et cetera. So what are we trying to achieve there going forward with the youth and vet weekend?
Yeah, so as you guys know, I mean, the last couple of years have been tough with the kids because there's been very little rest for their hunt. And part of the issue for that is we have the youth hunt, we have the vet hunt, which can only be within 14 days after the end of the regular season. But we also have, you know, this allowance to hunt all the way to January 31st. And as you guys know, our hunter surveys have shown people want to hunt as late as possible, particularly in the balance of the state zone. That's when some of the hunting is at its best.
Yeah.
All you got to do is go on the department's website and look at the wildlife area results on the last week or two in January, and you'll see typically they shoot pretty good. So the kids, unfortunately, haven't had the greatest opportunity the last couple of years. Of course, their hunt was the first postseason hunt to be authorized. Their hunt's been around since like the early 90s, maybe even earlier than that. The vet hunt is a much more recent addition. So what we're proposing for this upcoming season, because January 31st falls on a Saturday, there would be implications for how many rest days there are for the kids or the vets. So if we switch, though, the timing of the vet and the youth hunt so that the vets actually go first and then the kids go second, that will ensure at least 5 days of rest for the kids.
Or the youth hunt that following weekend.
Yeah. Okay. So that at least would, get them back to where they were. Obviously, the vets would get fewer rest days. But what we are recommending to the commission is that we use all of our authorized duck hunting days and go to the last Wednesday in January. Then we'd shut down for a couple days and then have the vet hunt that weekend. So there still would be 2 days of rest for the vet hunt.
Gotcha.
It's certainly not ideal. We want them to have 5 days. But again, because of where the calendar falls this upcoming season, we're kind of in this cramped position where we don't have a lot of wiggle room. The good thing is the following year, January 31st falls on a Sunday. And so that will ensure that both the youth and the veterans hunt, whichever weekends we have them on, get a full 5 days of rest.
Okay.
So every year is going to be different. Some years there's going to be more rest days than others, and we'll just have to kind of roll with it. Again, we do know from our hunter surveys that the bulk of the hunting population wants to hunt as late as possible. So we certainly want to make sure that we fulfill that.
Yeah, I think that's, excuse me, what some people misunderstand is that, you know, us three are sitting in the office or Mark's in his office and making this decision for the better of the people. But we're taking the opinions of the folks that are answering these post-hunter surveys to get the majority census and not just picking and choosing what works for us.
Absolutely. And of course, we have our regulations committee. So all of this goes through that committee, which is, you know, made up of volunteers who are just hardcore duck hunters. And so they also have, you know, come up with and reviewed this proposal and voted on it to, you know, and supported it. And then the final kind of layer of approval for us is it has to go through to the full CWA board. So typically they do go with the R&T committee, but not always. And, you know, that ensures, I think, that you're never going to have a perfect proposal, but that we're getting probably the greatest good for the greatest amount of hunters out of what we're, you know, offering to the commission. And so the process is very important. We want to make sure that it, all of these ideas, first, that we use, again, the hunter survey, but it, that they go through our R&T committee and the full board before we actually give a public recommendation to the state.
Now, what about the late goose season for the balance of the state? Is that going to start on the youth hunt weekend or is it a week after? Where would that lie in this new little plan?
Yeah, that's another element of this. So under this proposal that we're supporting, it'll be put back to the third weekend in February.
Okay.
Which I believe happens to be on President's Day weekend. So that way, you know, people.
Still a 5-day season?
It's still a 5-day
season. So it's starting even later?
Yeah. So
I think that's great.
Yeah. So this last year we put it, you know, on top of the veteran hunt, and which was great because the vets then also got to shoot geese. But obviously, if the vet hunt is going to go first, and there's only a couple days of rest prior to that, we wouldn't want the late season starting then.
Yeah.
Plus, then that would interfere with the youth hunt the following weekend. So the best place now under this scenario is to put it, you know, 3 weeks out. And we had historically done that. I mean, most years we've had that late goose hunt. It's fallen on President's Day weekend.
Yeah.
So there's pros and cons to it. Some years, you know, the birds are still around and you get a great hunt out of it. Other years, by that time, they've kind of scattered and the hunting isn't so great. But, you know, you can't predict these things.
No, especially the weather on the late goose, because, like, this last year, everything was looking good. It was warming up. Geese were getting on the green grass. And then we had, like, those 4 flooding day events and it just flooded everything out again. It kind of pushed birds everywhere.
That's the history we've had in the Butte Sink. We've had our late goose hunts and they've either been absolutely phenomenal or they've been flooded out. Yeah. And I think now we're trending towards majority in the past 6 years have been flooded out. We've just hit weird storms on that last like middle, early part of February.
Yep. Yeah.
But can't predict the weather. So.
Absolutely. Well, that's exciting. Now, what about the pintail limit? The increase for 3 a day.
Yeah. So as everybody knows, that's something CWA has worked on for 10 to 15 years and it's taken a long time. There's been a lot of frustration along the way, but hey, we finally got the federal authorization for it. So the way this is going to work is it's going to be an interim harvest strategy and they are going to have a threshold for getting 3 pintail that's frankly very reasonable. So in most years, we should be able to reach that. But because it is an interim strategy, what they want to do is have 3 years of a 3 pintail bag. And then after that has taken place, go back and analyze that, see what impacts, if any, occurred to the pintail population. And then they'll come up with a final harvest strategy. So hopefully, when they do that, that final harvest strategy will also include the 3 bird allowance. But we just don't know. It's always good to, you know, get more information. Of course, we're under adaptive harvest management. We're supposed to be periodically looking at the regulations and experimenting around to try to learn more. this fits into that. And I think we'll be a lot more knowledgeable once we get through this 3-year period.
So let's say if it does nothing to the population, is there a chance to increase that from 3 to 5 or et cetera, or where are we at with 3 to 7.
That? All right. Now we're getting greedy, boys. I would say most likely it would be just 3 birds, but there is a possibility. I mean, if you could show that, 4 or 5 birds wouldn't cause a problem, they'd certainly look at that. But at least right now, the scientific papers and a lot of the focus has been really on incrementally increasing it to 3 birds. And, you know, if that is sustainable or not, I'm not aware of other papers that look at increasing it up to 5 or 7 and okay. what that might do.
They wanted to make it realistic before they yeah. made the jump.
Well, will all the states in our flyway participate? How does that work with the increase to 3 birds? Will some states stay at 1 or is it across all flyways they can go up to 3?
It is across all flyways. You know, pintail, for better or worse, are managed from a continental perspective. So yes, this will apply to all flyways. But individual states are always able to decrease that. You know, they're given a framework and they can be more conservative. They just can't be more liberal.
Okay.
I've heard, you know, maybe some states would want to reduce the hen pintail limit down to 1. The problem with that is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been trying to get away from sex-specific regulations for a long time now. I don't see that happening in our state. I would think if our commission does go along and approve it, it's just going to be 3 of either sex. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you know, early in the season, it's a little bit harder to identify them. And they just, I think, want to make sure that that mistake bird is taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I want to touch on the 3-year interim strategy. So we can have 3 this year and then we could go 3 years potentially with back to 1, depending on what they see. And Correct. Then we could have 2 more years of 3. So people shouldn't be expecting 3, 3, 3 for 3 straight years, unless the numbers say we can do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, this could end up taking 10 years.
Yeah, that's their window they have. It just
depends on what the breeding numbers are going to be. Like I said, the threshold under this interim plan is it's a pretty reasonable one. So just looking at it, I'm guessing in many years we'll get to 3 birds. But no guarantees. And if we right now, there's a lot of drought in the southern prairies and, you know, things up in Canada aren't hunky dory necessarily. So that's always going to be a real impact on the number of pintail that breed.
Hmm. So this year, if they pass it, we'll get it. Well, we have the ability to have it. And then who knows for the years coming, but we'll have it hopefully 2 more times in the next 10 years.
Could be. We'll get to it at some point. Yep. Yeah. And then, yeah, it'll be great that the service then will have all this new data and they'll be able to come up with a final plan for managing the population. But again, I mean, if you don't try new things and experiment around, you're never going to learn. And that's why this whole process is really important. I think we'll have a much better understanding of the effects, if any, of harvest on pintail, because right now we don't have the right information.
Yeah. I know.
Exciting.
I know Klamath right now, I've gotten reports that it's full of water for the first time in like full of water for the first time in a long time, but we have a state grant that you can dive into that just CWA received. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Department of Fish and Wildlife has a number of water related grants and we applied and took a long time, but we were awarded a $2.25 million grant. So all of it's going to be focused on water and water related infrastructure on those refuges. I think a big portion of that will go for paying for pumping of water. As you guys know up there, you know, the pumping costs can be significant and the service cannot necessarily handle all those costs. So this would be a great way to reimburse them for moving water around the refuges. There's also some lift pump projects that we're going to be creating over on the Thule side, mostly Fry's Island. Mm-hmm. We'll get a lift pump. And then I also think there's a couple of proposals for lift pumps at 1B and 1A too. So that'll be great. And then, as you mentioned, I mean, this year the refuges, they have more water than they've had in years. So the great part about that is we actually will probably get back to some really good waterfowl production up there. You guys know, I mean, that unit two area on the lower Klamath side, when that is wet for a sustained amount of time, it can produce a tremendous amount of ducks and Canada mm-hmm. geese. So I would see a lot of birds being produced. And just the northeast zone in general is going to probably kick out a lot of birds this year. I've heard Devil's Garden's very wet. And then even the other state wildlife areas and refuges all have a lot more water than normal. So places like Modoc that have that summer water too, I think you'll see a lot of good production. And then, of course, too, when you have water at that time, that helps with the molt as well. And so a lot of birds will benefit. Bottom line is the hunting, you know, the first couple of weeks of the season up there should be pretty darn good. And I would guess particularly for mallards. So cross our fingers and keep our hopes up on that.
Nice. And can you give us an update on the water purchase that we made? And where that stands with the guaranteed water coming to the refuge and those water rights?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of our strategies for helping to fix the situation up in Klamath is acquiring permanent water rights. You know, once you have them, they're in perpetuity and you can rely on them for the most part year to year. And the refuges up there really have never had a senior permanent water right. So we were able to work with a landowner in the Wood River Valley of Oregon, and he was willing to sell his water and then actually transfer the water right to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's an extra, you know, I think it's 3,750 acre feet, you know, so not a whole lot, but still it's, you know, any water up there is a good thing. And that water specifically will help to keep units two and three wet during the summer. Mm-hmm. That's when that water will be made available. So hopefully it can also not only just protect all those breeding birds in there and all the waterfowl broods, make sure that they're not stranded, but also lessen the opportunity for any botulism outbreak. As you guys know, I mean, that's been a particularly mm-hmm. bad issue up in the basin with all these dry water years. So that water hopefully will reduce that possibility.
And that thing is done, paid for, and all that? Or are we still
it
waiting?
It closed. It is done.
Right.
Finally done. Good so work. Yeah, we're really, really pleased about that. And hopefully we can build on that and approach other landowners. Again, these are all voluntary agreements. It's incentive-based. I mean, it's working cooperatively with them. We're not regulating anybody or just taking their water right. Mm-hmm. But if there are willing sellers out there and, you know, we can meet on a price, it's just a great way to provide more water for the refuges. Stillwater Refuge over in Nevada, they had horrible water problems for years, and their strategy was to go out and acquire these senior water rights. And now they have a much more stable supply of water. Of course, it's not perfect. You know, they're always looking for new water, but mm-hmm. they've gotten a much better ability to manage their property there and provide water for wildlife.
That's awesome. That's good. Now, can you touch on some of the things in that we're supporting in the state legislation? One, you mentioned mute swans and kind of where we're at with that. I think everyone's seen an uptick in mute swans around the Sassoon Marsh and in the California Delta. If you are a fisherman, hunter, et cetera, where frankly, a few years ago, they're just, you didn't see a whole lot. And now they're seem like they're everywhere.
Up. Yep. So. Funny how they show up and every year you just seem to see more of those around.
Yep.
So, and we always try, you know, CWA to run our own proactive bills every year. We don't want to just be down at the Capitol playing defense. You know, so if there's an opportunity to push pro hunting legislation through, we'll do it. And so this would be one of those examples. Essentially what it would do, it's AB 764 is the bill. The vice chair of the Water Parks and Wildlife Committee, a guy by the name of Gonzalez, is running the bill for us, which we really appreciate. This was actually just heard in committee the other day and actually got out with no votes. So that was really great. But what the bill would do is allow not only landowners, but anybody with a hunting license to take mute swans year round. And so that would really provide an extra opportunity. I mean, yeah, if you're hunting down in the marsh or in the Delta, you probably have a pretty good chance of getting at one of those. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to, you know, expand hunting to new species, but also you're helping to control these things because mute swans, if you know anything about them, they are highly territorial, highly aggressive. They actually drive ducks and geese off of breeding grounds because they're so aggressive. They have these very large territories and they won't let any other kind of bird within those territories. The other thing they do, you know, they're large birds. They're up to 25 pounds. Apparently, they eat up to 8 pounds of wetland vegetation a day.
Jesus.
So if you get hundreds of those sitting out on a pond, yeah. I mean, you could do some real damage. So they are an actual threat to the wetlands themselves by degrading food resources for other birds.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, just down at Quimby Island, when we're just going to the island, like they're just all over Frank's track and in the sloughs and just kind of all over the place.
So hypothetically, everything goes perfectly. When does this get taken place? Like when can somebody go out and potentially harvest one?
Yeah. And of course the legislative process is a long one. So just because we got the bill out of the first committee, we still have many hurdles to go, but it would go through the process in the legislature and then you'd get to September. And if it makes it to the governor's desk, then he would have 30 days to sign or veto it. If he was to sign it, it would take effect January 1st of 2026. So within the middle of our next hunting season, become that quick.
Okay. Yep.
We'd have to change all of our hunter packets that we hand out at our properties.
Well, you need to show the differences between the two for sure. Yeah. But if you're just a normal duck hunter, it's pretty obviously just the way their wings sound too.
What about all the people that, you know, like, talking about how they're in D10, all the guys that buy rice blinds and they don't see anything, they just sit there and watching swans like off a 99. It's like, this could be the year. They get 3 pintail and swans in January. Can you imagine that?
I don't know how many mute swans are up there, but they'd
most
have
of those are tundra.
Are those tundras?
Yeah. But hey, at least it'd be some opportunity to kill a swan. And, you know, from what I've heard, if they're eating on the right thing, they actually taste pretty good. So
I don't see why not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we get that thing through, and again, we'll know by September.
All right, so we have another bill, AB 1169. It's a bill to expand the number of hunting and fishing opportunities under the SHARE program. What is that bill trying to do, and what is the SHARE program and our involvement at the beginning of that?
Yeah, so that's a public access to private lands program, you know, mostly focused on hunting. A number of other states across the country have these access programs. So California's, CWA sponsored a bill in 2003, which, by the way, had, I think, 27 animal rights groups in opposition just for creating a hunting program. And it was one of the closest votes I've ever seen on any bill throughout the process. I mean, each time we were able to move it, it would pass by one or two votes.
Wow.
And fortunately, at the time, we had some friends in the governor's office that were pro-hunting. And so Gray Davis ended up signing that bill into law and creating the program. It's an incentive-based approach to providing hunting access. The way it works is willing landowners are paid a set amount of dollars per acre or amount of each hunting participant, they can get paid that way too by the number of participants. And the state also covers their liability. Of course, liability is huge with a lot of private landowners. They don't want to get sued. Someone breaks their leg out there. So the good thing is other than gross negligence, all of their liability is taken care of. And it took a little while for the department to really get the program up and running. And if you go on the department's website now, there are a number of hunts on there, which is great. So, I mean, it is a a program that is off the ground. The unfortunate thing is it's really just focused on big game and other species. There's not a lot of waterfowl hunts that are provided there. And I would say most of the opportunities are for big game. There are some quail hunts, some other bird hunts, but it's mostly been a big game type program. So what we'd like to do is see the not only the number of hunts expand, but again, these other species that really haven't been part of the program include them there. So when we originally passed that bill, we were forced to put in a restriction on how much you could pay the landowner. And so that was not adjusted ever, and it was not adjusted for inflation. So basically what the department is able to pay the landowners today was what they were paying back in 2003, 2004. Wow. Mm. So this bill would adjust that or allow the department, it wouldn't even adjust it. It would say that it's really up to the department to determine how much to pay the landowner. We think with that extra incentive, a lot more landowners would be willing to participate. And again, if we could focus some of that on waterfowl hunts, that would be great for our members, obviously.
Yeah.
And then there's also opportunities that will be in the bill for the department to cooperate with nonprofit sportsmen's groups. A lot of groups like ourselves and, you know, National Wild Turkey Federation, Pheasants Forever, they have really good relationships with private landowners that the department may not necessarily have. So by involving those groups, you're probably going to get a lot more outreach to interested landowners, and that'll be a key to really expanding the program.
Exciting news. Our hunt program is now accepting applications for spring turkey and pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply. We're also offering free mentored turkey hunts at Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge and Delvin National Wildlife Refuge, an incredible opportunity for new hunters to gain hands-on experience in the field. Camp Sprig registration is now open. If you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, we have 4 2.5-day camps designed to provide hands-on learning and certification. These camps take place June through July. While you're there, don't miss our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for California Waterfowl Association. Upcoming events are Redding Banquet, April 12th, Gold Rush Banquet, April 19th, Napa Sonoma Banquet, April 19th, Lake County Recruitment Meeting and Social, April 23rd. Don't miss out. Visit calwaterfowl.org now.
Next we have, the sustainable ground water management, obviously extremely hard in some areas to get surface water and or groundwater at times. So AB 929, what is that and what will it accomplish?
Yeah. So this is a follow-up bill to one that was vetoed, unfortunately, last year, dealing with essentially exemptions from the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, for managed wetlands. Because it was vetoed last year, we're reintroducing it this year. We're working with, you know, our other bird conservation partners on it. Grassland Water District is another partner on this. But what it would do is, in places where SGMA is threatening to impose restrictions on groundwater pumping and increasing fees on landowners, it would provide an exemption for certain managed wetlands. So like those that are on state wildlife areas, those that are under a conservation easement, those that are, you know, have a habitat agreement with the Department of Fish and Wildlife or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So we're really trying to focus on the best of the best wetlands to be given this type of relief. You have areas like the Tulare Basin that are horribly overdrafted, right? The groundwater resources there are very limited. But you have duck clubs too that are almost wholly, if not entirely, reliant on groundwater. Well, right now, because of SGMA implementation, every year those clubs are getting the amount of pumping they can do ratcheted down. And eventually it will be to where they can't even flood up their properties. So if we don't pass this AB 929 and get some kind of limited exceptions to it, you're going to basically see duck clubs go out of business in certain parts of the state. Obviously, we want to avoid that. We need more wetland habitat, not less. So this, you know, hopefully will be supported. It was supported in the legislature. We just really now have to convince the governor's office that it's worthwhile to sign. So that I think the bulk of the discussions over this bill are going to be with them.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's sad. I mean, you look at those areas like, you know, in Kern and all the duck clubs, et cetera, flourished at one time, you know, and to be so handcuffed now, it's expensive to run a duck club anyways, but when you're paying what they're paying for acre footage of water, et cetera, it comes to a point where it's like, you know, you just can't afford it. The club members can't afford it, whoever, extremely hard. And they're not super big clubs anyways.
Yeah, they're not giant super clubs.
Yeah, they're not like 2,000 acres or something like that. They're usually on the smaller side, but yeah. But,
you know, the way we've always done wetland conservation, not only in California, but throughout the rest of the U.S., is through a non-regulatory, landowner-friendly, incentive-based approach. And that's worked so well for us. I mean, that's why we have the waterfowl habitat and the waterfowl numbers that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start regulating, though, and going the other direction, all of that becomes in jeopardy, because a lot of landowners, if they're regulated, they're just going to throw up their hands and say, it's not worth my effort. We've got to make sure that those incentives stay in place, and this we make putting wetlands out on the landscape as easy as possible. You put impediments in people's way, they're just going to go and convert that land to some other use, and we're going to lose those wetlands. So it's really important that we stay with that incentive-based approach. It's worked so well for us. We don't want these new regulations to get in the way of that.
Was there any feedback as why it was vetoed?
There was some. If you look at the veto message, the bill also provided exemptions for certain small community water systems, and much of the veto message was focused on that. So we're hopeful that the wetland portion wasn't really the problem. It was this other provision in the bill. But we still need to have more conversations with the governor's office to make sure that the wetland portion is okay with them.
Okay.
So next we've got AB 1038, bringing back the pursuit of bears with dogs.
Yeah. I'll tell you, one of the saddest days I've ever seen was when the governor signed into law, you know, years ago, the ban on using dogs on, you know, bears and bobcats. I mean, I just felt for those houndsmen that, you know, using the dogs is everything to them. And now you've taken that away from them. I mean, if somebody took our labs away for duck hunting, how devastating that would be for a lot of people. That adds great enjoyment to the hunt. It's no different than, you know, for the houndsmen. It's all about the dogs for them. Many of them, frankly, they're not even interested in killing the bear. They just want to pursue them and tree them. That's it. And that's the success for them, is how many bears can they tree in a year. So this bill would try to reverse the hound ban that was passed years ago. What it would do is start by allowing houndsmen just to pursue bears with dogs, just for pursuit purposes, not to harvest. Yep. Correct. But we also have a pending bear management plan that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is considering right now. That should be complete in another year or two. Once that is complete, then under the bill too, the Fish and Game Commission could actually authorize a hunt where the bear is actually taken using hounds, depending on what's in that management plan. So yeah, this is kind of like a two-step process. Initially, it would be just for pursuit purposes, but eventually it could lead to bears actually being taken with the aid of hounds, which we think is great. I mean, bear numbers are through the roof. We mm-hmm. all know they're a major predator of fawns, and that's a limiting factor on our deer populations. It's just like any other animal. It just needs to be managed. We want healthy populations of these things, but they have to be managed and can't just be completely uncontrolled the way they are now for the most part. In most years, if not all, we don't reach the bear harvest quota. So this would also then eventually, if we were able to use hounds, hopefully help us to get near that that quota mark. And again, better keep the population in check.
When we were using hounds, was the quota met more often?
It was. Yep.
Like pretty regularly, right?
I think so. So, I mean, every year is different, but yeah, I believe in the majority of years, they would reach the quota by like December.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have we ever floated a spring bear hunt idea? Has that ever been talked about?
It's been discussed. That one probably would have massive opposition down at the Capitol.
Gotcha.
And so we're trying to look at other ways that we can float legislation that, you know, is maybe a little more palatable and try that first. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, this particular bill, there's already massive animal rights opposition. It's going to have a very tough hill to climb. Okay. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And you just hope too, even if the bill fails, if we can educate decision makers down at the Capitol about proper bear conservation, about why people use dogs, the whole culture around that, you know, maybe over time that can make a difference. And, you know, if we're not able to get the bill through this year, maybe in a couple of years, the timing will be better.
Okay. And now we have SB 818, which is a pilot program to allow houndsmen to pursue mountain lions with dogs.
Yeah. So this would also then allow houndsmen to, you know, use their dogs again. Would just be, though, to try to go into problem areas and, you know, use dogs to basically for public safety purposes and to reduce depredation. So, you know, there's been kind of a hot spot in El Dorado and even neighboring Placer counties where we've had some fatalities. This last year, there were two young men out. I believe they were just looking for deer horns. And doing that, and they got attacked by a mountain lion, and unfortunately, one of the brothers didn't make it. And I can only imagine how painful that was for the surviving brother to have to see and witness that and deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So these things really are, they're a human threat, for sure. I remember back in the early 90s, we had Barbara Schroener, who was jogging up, I believe, in the Auburn State Recreation Area, which is nearby. She also was killed. So again, it's just, these are large animals that need to be managed. We're not talking about trying to, you know, get rid of them entirely, but like any wildlife species, they need to be managed, so that, they, you know, fit in with the ecosystem the right way. Our ecosystems in California are forever changed. So if man doesn't step in and actually help to manage, things are going to be completely out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not dealing with the same conditions we had when the state was created back in 1850. A lot of things have changed. This bill would provide a little bit of relief. It would be a pilot program for 5 years, see if hazing these, you know, mountain lions with dogs, if that was effective in cutting down on safety and depredation issues. And then analyze that data at the end of the day. And again, if you never try new things, you're never going to learn. This kind of goes back to the pintail issue. There could be some really good information that would come out from this pilot that we'd all benefit from.
Okay.
So those were all bills that CWA is supporting. Flip the script and go to our opposition. The first one, AB 1316. Would require Department of Fish and Wildlife to include with the sale of hunting licenses certain information related to gun laws and safety, so on. So dive into that one for me.
Yeah, of course, you know, at the Capitol every year we have anti-gun bills. I mean, it's just an onslaught. It never lets up. And, you know, the next two bills I'll talk about fit right in there. Some years the bills are really bad. You know, other years, we still oppose them, but, you know, maybe they're not quite as significant as other measures we've seen. So it depends on the year, but we always have some gun bills of some sort. Our whole goal at CWA is just to make sure that there's minimal or no impacts on hunters. So we really look, I mean, does this have some kind of nexus to hunting? That's our primary outlook on this. We do by the way, though, sign on to opposition letters with CRPA and NRA on other gun bills that may not so much have a hunting nexus, but we also want to stand up for the Second Amendment and for gun rights in general. So we do try to make sure that we weigh in on as many of these bills as possible. So the two I, you know, was going to discuss today, one actually does deal directly with hunting. It would require Department of Fish and Wildlife, this is AB 1316, to include a bunch of information on gun safety with the sale of every hunting license. That doesn't sound too bad, right? But as you guys already know, we already go through hunter safety. And why should somebody then have to, if they've already gone through that and they've learned about firearm laws and, you know, the proper way to store or use firearms, why should they then be bombarded with more safety information? It really, to me, is not necessary. The bigger concern is every time the Department of Fish and Wildlife is forced to change its automated license data system where you buy your license, there is a massive cost to that because of the way the system's set up. Even minor tweaks to that ALDS system mm-hmm. have a big price tag. And where do you think that... That, you know, if more money is needed for this, where do you think it's going to come from? It's going to come from our Fish and Game Preservation Fund. And so then we're going to see less conservation out on the landscape. So you're basically going to have to rob Peter to pay Paul. And I don't think hunters should have to pay more for safety information that they already are aware of. Hunters, as we all know, are the safest of all gun users. In most years, there's no fatalities from hunting and only a handful of accidents. And that is because of the 8-hour course, 10-hour course that we have to take through the Department of Fish and Wildlife and just the emphasis on safety within our community. So we're taking care of our shop. Why should we be harassed with more requirements for safety when clearly we're not part of the gun violence problem?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. It's getting harder and harder, just anything as a gun owner, if you get someone into hunting, just all of the little steps you have to take and know about, it's getting, you know,
yeah, it's overkill. Yep. And frankly, you know, we think some of the hidden agenda is, well, if we just regulate this stuff enough, this would be from legislators' perspective, you know, we may not ban it entirely, but if you make it so difficult for someone to participate in that activity or so expensive, they're just going to give it up. So it almost, you know, with too many of these laws, it becomes like de facto gun ban or hunting bans.
Mm-hmm.
If you make it so hard on people, they're just not going to participate. And, you know, we're near that point. There's a lot of hunters that complain about all the regulations, all the requirements, all the fees. You know, it's our job at CWA to keep those at a minimum.
And now we have AB 1187. A firearm safety certificates, what does that exactly entail and what's the goal behind that?
Yeah, so this bill would do a couple of things. First, it would require anybody moving into California or bringing firearms into California to have to obtain a firearm safety certificate within 60 days. Now, most people moving into a new state, are they going to be aware that there's this requirements on the book? I doubt it. So after 60 days, they're basically going to be committing misdemeanor offenses. That's what it is under this bill.
Jeez.
If you don't comply within 60 days and get that certificate, you would be violating the law and have a misdemeanor on your record. So to me, that also, for the people that do know too, it's probably a disincentive for them to even want to bring guns into the state. And, you know, it's like, why deal with that, the hassle of it? The firearm safety certificate, it used to be that, well, currently, you know, it's something that can be done while you're going to get your gun at Sportsman's Warehouse.
When I worked at Sportsman's Warehouse, exactly. I used to hand them out. And it was a multi-question paper test, and that's all you did. And that's why I saw the second part of this kind of took me back.
And now they're going to require under this bill that you do a full 8-hour course.
Yeah, which is mind-blowing.
Which also, again, makes no sense for people that already have their hunting license. They've already done all that. So, again, it's just more overkill. It's going to be a big disincentive for people to participate. And this would not then, that firearm safety certificate part, it wouldn't just apply to new people. If you were going to purchase a gun here in California, you're a longtime resident like all of us, you then would also then have to get this certificate and take that 8-hour course. So, you know, you've already taken your hunter safety years ago, and now you're going to have to take another course for 8 hours. And I mean, it's at what point is enough? You know, it's like they're just piling this stuff on. And again, I think the real agenda at the end of the day is to keep people from hunting and just shooting recreationally. They just don't want you in the state to own a firearm. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So these are the kind of, you know, hunting harassment type bills that, you know, we're going to oppose, and we're going to work with some of our other partner groups down at the Capitol, and hopefully we can stop at least these two.
Is there anything else coming down the pipe that, you know, hunters and fishermen and shooters should be aware of?
There was another bill that was introduced in the last few days that deals with bringing in game from other countries.
Okay.
And as you know, that's been a hot topic at the federal level, what animal parts you can bring in taxidermied. So that's another one we may have to oppose. A lot of our members go to Africa or go to other countries to pursue their hunting, and they should have every right. If it's legal in that country and those countries believe that those animals are not threatened or endangered, you should have the right to bring that back. If not, that animal product just goes to waste. So why would we want to be wasteful? But as you all know, taxidermy, it's a form of art. It's a great way to educate people. I mean, zoos and museums have taxidermy up there. So if it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for us. The great thing is, you know, when you have friends over and you got a bunch of taxidermy up on the wall, I mean, I got 10 ducks and geese. Each one of those tells a story, you know, how it was hunted, how it was harvested. That's a great way, again, to get people to appreciate what we do as hunters and hopefully understand, you know, why we hunt and all the benefits that go along with that.
Nice. So like on that particular bill, it'd be, you know, couldn't import a Ibex or whatever if you shot it. Is it just a flat out ban if it's not killed in North America, or is it just specifically like trophy hunting in Africa?
It would apply to anything that is currently banned through the Endangered Species Act in the United States. So if right now U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated the take of certain species to be off limits, it would basically keep that in place in California forever. And so even if the law changed, you know, we have the new Trump administration now in there, they're probably going to look at some of those species on those lists and say, you know what, there's enough science to show that these things are not threatened or endangered, and therefore hunters should be able to legally bring those parts back into the United States. But unfortunately, if this bill passes in California, you wouldn't be able to bring them into California. And again, that a lot of the reason people travel that far, it's not just for the experience, but the ability to bring something back. I mean, that's very understandable. You want to be able to appreciate all that time and effort that you put into pursuing that animal. What's a better way to do that than to have a taxidermied, you know, animal or part of an animal as a keepsake? So we just want to make sure that that's protected, and that folks that do go over and travel to other countries are able to bring all of their animals home.
Okay. And if someone wants to stay up to date, and, you know, there's, I think, one recently about something to do with coyote hunting as well that I got some calls about. I mean, how does someone stay up to date on what's going on, and how could people make a difference?
Well, certainly we have our legislative website. So just go to legislative page on the CWA site. There's a lot of the current information on there. We do action alerts, you know, periodically. We try not to use it too often because we don't want to wear people out. But if we really need help in weighing in with decision makers, and it's a really hot topic, we'll, you know, put that out on our voter voice. So that would be the other thing, is to sign up for the voter voice. There's a place you can do that on the website under the legislative page. We just, you know, want to make sure that we're giving our members all the tools possible to help us, because it's, you know, it's one thing for me as a lobbyist to go in and ask for something, but when you get, you know, real people, who are constituents of some of these legislators to weigh in, that can really help move the issue along in our favor. So I'd always highly recommend, if we do put an alert out to our membership, to utilize that, because your voice definitely does make a difference. We talk to other legislators that receive these after, and they'll a lot of times say, you know, gosh, I was inundated with hundreds or thousands of emails, and that really caught my attention. So even though you may not get a response back from that legislator necessarily, trust me, it does affect their thinking. So please take advantage of it and use it when we send it out. That'd be very helpful.
Okay. Yeah, good to know. Well, cool. Well, Mark, we appreciate you fighting the good fight, and we appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you. Always interesting things going on down at that Capitol. I at times wish they would just go on a full summer recess and never come back. But we have a full-time legislature in California, so this isn't going away. And I think, you know, over time, the issues have even gotten more difficult. The good thing is, we've talked about this before, we have a great story to tell as hunters and everything we do in terms of conservation and all the benefits that go along with it. We just got to be able to, you know, relate that story to these decision makers. Because I think once, if they're willing to listen and once they hear our story, they're going to be a lot more apt to be on our side. So education is very important in our world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for everything that you do for the hunter community. We definitely appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.